It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about the art of communication during extreme weather events.
First, the state legislature's budget committee voted last night to reject Governor Walker's proposed cuts to income and sales taxes. The governor had proposed a $200 million income tax cut and a $22 million back-to-school sales tax holiday. The committee also rejected the governor's proposal to increase the earned income tax credit.
Todd Berry is the president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, and he joins us for analysis on last night's action on taxes. Todd, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back. Thank you.
Before we dig into the specific taxes, Todd, big picture, what do you make of what came out of joint finance?
Yeah, a couple impressions. I guess the biggest is when you look at how they generated revenue, it was mainly by getting rid of that income tax cut and the sales tax holiday, which, by the way, I don't think hardly anybody in tax policy work has much regard for a sales tax holiday. They don't work. But that generates a couple hundred million dollars over the biennium. And when you look at what they did, they have gotten rid of the state property tax. It's a small one. They have begun the process, which has been going on for 150 years, of killing off the personal property tax. And they also did something quite curious that had the effect of increasing the lottery property tax credit. So I guess the theme would be state general fund tax cuts out, various kinds of property tax cuts in.
And let's talk about those property tax cuts. And I think when people hear ending kinds of property tax, that doesn't mean people aren't going to be paying property tax next year. The school-related property taxes, they're all still there, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It's just that, we pay about gross over $10 billion of property taxes a year. So when we talk about $80 million here or $40 million there, I mean, it's worth keeping in some context as well.
But that one that was cut, the personal property tax, that relates to small business. Can you talk about what changes in this budget and what kind of impact that would have?
Yeah, well, the personal property tax is all that's left of a property tax that used to apply to all our furnishings, livestock, vehicles, et cetera, et cetera. And over many years, the legislature has been continuing to exempt parts of that. And what's left is sort of some cats and dogs that are mainly business personal property. They have not entirely gotten rid of this tax. They're only going after one part of it, which has to do with manufacturing tools and patterns and some language like that.
And then moving on to income tax, the governor proposed a $200 million income tax cut. Republican State Senator Alberta Darling of River Hills, who's a co-chair of the Budget Committee, said, "We didn't want to do it. It wasn't a big enough tax cut to, I guess, waste our time on, it sounds like." John Nygren, other co-chair, said it didn't give the best bang for your buck.
Mm-hmm.
So how would this income tax cut have worked?
Yeah, well, it was just a reduction in bottom tax rates in the income tax. So it would have some benefit to everybody that paid income tax. But again, it was, as the legislator suggested, it was a pretty small tax cut. And when you have a $250 billion to $300 billion state economy, $100 million a year is not going to move the needle. I'm not saying people wouldn't appreciate it, but they're also going to see some benefits on some of their property tax bills, too. So it's, pick your preferred tax relief.
And then the Budget Committee also rejected a proposal from the governor to increase the earned income tax credit. First of all, can you tell us what the earned income tax credit is and how it works?
Yeah, it was originally a federal program, and actually its roots are more Republican, going back to Reagan and Ford at the federal level, that provided refundable tax credits to the working poor, to people that were working and earning money but having trouble getting out of poverty. And the Wisconsin Earned Income Tax Credit was piggybacked on that federal credit and historically was even more generous to families with children. Back in, I believe, his first budget, the governor scaled back to some degree that earned income tax credit, particularly on larger families. And it appeared what he was doing with his proposal was sort of trying to backtrack a bit and essentially give back some of the cut that he had executed before. You know, why the legislature did what it did, again, I think at the bottom line is they're dealing with a budget that was very narrowly balanced. They've got a lot of other needs, schools, university, property tax cuts, and they were trying to generate cash. And this is one of the places they got it.
Talking to Todd Berry from the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance about tax-related action in the state budget from the Joint Finance Committee yesterday. Both of the things we just talked about, earned income tax credit and those income tax cuts, as you said, focused on lower incomes, they were things that target lower income earners. There's a case people make that that's the best kind of tax cut. Those are people who will get that money and then spend it right away as opposed to saving it. The other argument is, no, focus on the businesses. They'll invest it, create jobs for those low-income people. How does this all stack up in this budget?
Well, and that you've captured the ongoing debate. The income tax cut, although it cut the bottom rates, benefited all taxpayers, I should say. So it wasn't targeted at low-income payers the way the earned income tax credit was. And, you know, for your typical working middle-class family, you can put on the balance, would you rather have more of a lottery property tax credit to benefit homeowners and not have to pay one of the property taxes that has historically been on your bill, the state forestry tax, or did you want the income tax cut? I think the legislature felt that by ending one property tax and moving down the path toward eliminating another, that they were doing something more concrete than merely doing a sales tax holiday, which was a one-time thing that, again, most people don't think is effective. And, you know, an income tax cut that was relatively small.
You've seen a lot of budgets come and go, Todd. This one was a couple months late, even though there's one party in control. Does that have consequences on what comes out in the end of the budget?
Well, you know, as I go through these motions, I am really struck by the number of very small, narrow provisions, tiny little sales tax exemptions, little tweaks in statute. And I can't help but think that the time delay gave local governments that wanted law changes, lobbyists that wanted law changes, state agency lobbyists that wanted law changes, everybody a bit of a chance to identify either what they didn't like in the budget or something they wanted change in state law, and it gave them time to get those items in. You're really struck by it in the tax area, you know, the big piece, the sales tax and the income tax changes, and then there are just a slew of very small tweaks of sales tax exemptions for beekeepers and fish sales and on and on.
Yeah, that talk about the process there. I mean, does it happen that a beekeeper talks to their neighbor, the lawmaker, and that makes it? How does that end up in there?
It could very well be. And by the way, I should disclose that I am the father of a beekeeper. when you have several months when the legislature really isn't doing much and lawmakers are sort of on vacation and home, it gives local constituents, local government officials, lobbyists, everybody more time to make contact with their lawmaker. And they don't always get this opportunity when the governor's budget comes out and it's, you know, it's on a fairly fast track and it's approved by the Finance Committee in May and it becomes law, you know, passed in June, and it's done. That's not all bad, because if there were bad things in the budget, they probably got vetted more, too.
And Todd, before we wrap up, looming over this budget process is this whole Foxconn thing, the big electronics manufacturer looking to open the plant here in Wisconsin, tax credits, this and that. How did that, or what is that, what do you think about when you look at that in the future?
Yeah, well, this budget doesn't get to Foxconn directly. There's another bill that will be considered at almost the same time. And I haven't seen the final budget numbers in terms of how the numbers work out. But the legislature says that it increased the state's ending balance, its savings. And what that tells me is they know what's coming, which is potentially some expenditures related to refundable tax credits to Foxconn, and they were trying to sock away a little money to lessen the hit from that.
We'll leave it there for now. Todd, thanks for being with us again today.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's Todd Berry, president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. He joined us for analysis on tax cuts passed and not passed by the Budget Committee last night.
Coming up, our guest meteorologist from the Weather Channel says communication matters in the era of climate change. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a psychiatrist says the rise of President Trump is a symptom of a world in distress. We'll find out why coming up.
Right now, several parts of the United States are in the grip of severe weather. There's recovery after flooding from Hurricane Harvey in Texas. Hurricane Irma is expected to hit Florida later this week, and dry conditions in the Pacific Northwest and California are leading to outbreaks of wildfire, some of which are burning out of control.
Our next guest is a meteorologist for the Weather Channel, and he specializes in how to communicate effectively during extreme weather and natural disasters. He's in Madison tonight for a public talk at 7 p.m. at the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery.
Marshall Shepard is with us now. He's the host of Weather Geeks on the Weather Channel and a former NASA scientist and distinguished professor and director of the University of Georgia's Atmospheric Sciences Program. Marshall, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, weather-wise, it seems like it's been an incredible few weeks. First, there was Hurricane Harvey and the flooding that followed, now Hurricane Irma. And as a meteorologist and a professional communicator, what is it like for your job? What's the most important part of communication in situations like this?
Well, let me clarify. I'm actually a professor at the University of Georgia. I do host the show on the Weather Channel called Weather Geeks, and I hope your listeners do watch that. My day job is a professor at UGA, and one of the things that I focus on is that we kind of look at this notion of weather and how people consume information on weather and climate. That's one of the things I'll be talking about tonight here in Madison. We're seeing it with Hurricane Harvey. We are seeing with Hurricane Irma. One of the biggest challenges with Harvey, for example, was the fact that we had a double barrel or a 1-2 punch storm, and I think many people underestimated the rainfall because it's often difficult to message rainfall in the same way that we message tornadoes and hurricanes. I think people just inherently perceive more risk with those things than rainfall, which they have more experience with. Irma is an entirely different story and something that I'm very concerned about. It's shaping up to be perhaps a worst-case scenario for South Florida.
And you use the word message. What does that mean when we're talking about weather and extreme events like this?
Absolutely. So when you watch TV meteorologists, which is where most people get their information, there are sort of preconceived perceptions about weather information. So, for example, people generally think they understand what 30% chance of rain means, but our experience shows that most people actually don't. When we talk about hurricanes, people see the cone of uncertainty presented and think they sort of understand that that means it's going down the center of the cone and may have some error. That's not what that cone means at all. It's really a representation of uncertainty and models over a given period of time and how that conveys to this particular storm. So we have some challenges and some jargon and some tendencies within the meteorological community that don't convey well, and then human beings have their own sort of perception. So, for example, with Irma, which is shaping up to be a very significant and very scary situation in South Florida, and there are people that will still say, oh, I've seen hurricanes like this before. I've been through them before. Well, no, you haven't been through anything like Irma. No, we haven't seen anything like Hurricane Harvey before. 50 inches of rain, we haven't seen that. That was a new normal in some regards. And so trying to get people to understand that is a very difficult challenge.
And so on the one hand, you've got people who might respond to news like this by thinking, been there, done that, I've seen this before. On the other hand, it also seems like extreme weather events can cause people to slide into conspiracy theories. And we saw today on PolitiFact that PolitiFact had to rate the claim that Hurricane Irma was going to destroy New York. It's pants on fire. It's not true. But how do you deal with that part of it?
Yeah, we, again, these are very much topics that I'll be talking about tonight. So hopefully some of your listeners will come out. You know, we do have a challenge now of not only communicating basic meteorological or weather information, we also have to now sift through the noise of a lot of voices out there on Twitter and social media giving their opinion and perspective on storms, fake news stories like that. I mean, just the other day I saw an old tornado picture getting around the internet that people were saying was Hurricane Irma. It was an old tornado picture that I've seen many times. So we are in this era where people want clicks and attention and likes on their pages at the expense of fact. And so that just makes our job as meteorologists and people that are trying to convey very real threats. I mean, if you your opening was spot on. In the last 3 weeks or so, we've had 50 inches of rain from Hurricane Harvey. We have one of the strongest hurricanes, Irma, that we've ever seen. San Francisco broke a record at 106 degrees, and we have wildfires burning in the west. These are unprecedented weather events, and we need a clear message for the public on them.
Are there some ways that social media, though, makes your job easier? Because if you have information that's time-sensitive, it can spread very quickly. You can spread it, and then it can be passed around, for instance. Does that help?
That is correct. Yeah, I am a big fan of social media. You know, your listeners can follow me, actually, at @DrShepard2013 on Twitter, and I use the format quite vigorously because it particularly Twitter and Snapchat, some of the more instantaneous social media platforms, they can provide very useful warning information, ground truthing on whether there is actually a tornado on the ground in locations. I actually typically go to Twitter first when I want to know what's going on with a breaking weather story. There are some social media sites like Facebook, for example, though, that aren't very good for instantaneous information because the algorithm is delayed. Some information that gets posted on Facebook you may see 1 minute from now or 1 week from now. It's just how that particular algorithm works. So I often caution people to make sure they understand the instantaneous nature of the platform they're using, because some are actually better than others.
We're talking with Marshall Shepard right now. He's host of the Weather Geeks and director of the University of Georgia's Atmospheric Sciences Program. And Marshall, right now there is a lot of political charge around the issue of climate change, and not everybody is on the same page. How do you deal with that effectively? Is weather, you know, politicized in a way that it hasn't been before?
Well, it is. I mean, I think it's a challenge because I think that climate change is certainly a real phenomena. Humans are contributing to it, and I think there's been a difficult time in some circles communicating that broadly to the public and to policymakers. Because of that, I think there is a tendency to want to politicize extreme events like we see. Now, is there likely some influence or impact of climate change on some of the recent extreme events that we are seeing? Perhaps so. I was a co-author on a National Academy of Sciences study last year that looked at this notion of what we call attribution of extreme weather to climate change, and that report is kind of definitive on the state of that science. However, I tend to want to let some of those attribution studies play out when we talk about Irma or Hurricane Harvey. I think it's sort of disingenuous or jumping the gun to some degree to sort of link those without doing the studies to confirm them. And when we do that, I think we hurt credibility. To give you a little quick analogy here, you think about a baseball player on steroids. I probably can't say that his 300th home run was caused by steroid use, but I can probably look at his overall statistics and conclude that steroid use inflated his overall statistics. And that is how I tend to like to think about some of the extreme events we're seeing in the context of climate change.
No, your talk tonight in Madison, it's called Zombies, Sports, and Cola. What do they mean for communicating weather and climate?
Yes.
I don't want you to give it all away, but give us a sneak preview. Do those things actually, you know, come together?
Believe it or not, if you come out to, I believe it's the Institute for Discovery, I don't even know the exact name, you can correct me, but if you come out to that tonight, I promise you that I am going to link Zombies, Sports, and Cola to a very sort of public, accessible discussion of the challenges and solutions for communicating extreme weather and climate. There are linkages. I'm a scientist, but this is a talk that I make very accessible to just the generally interested public or the science-attentive public. So I look forward to meeting the folks in Madison tonight.
And as we go through all of the weather events going on right now, the aftermath of Harvey, Irma, who is not through the hurricane there, and the wildfires, the dry conditions, what are you looking for and hoping for from weather communicators like yourself?
Well, what I really hope to see is sort of a communication clarity. In other words, I was talking today here to some of the students at the University of Wisconsin, and there's so much sort of difficulty separating signal from the noise today, the noise being different opinions, people thinking they're experts in certain topics, even though they aren't, just different voices, fake news. How do we have a sort of a clarity of the signal that's being delivered to policymakers, decision makers, and the public? For example, Hurricane Harvey. Meteorologists like myself knew for several days in advance that was going to be a 3-4 feet event or even more, yet I still saw decision makers say they didn't know it was going to be that bad, or they didn't know it was coming when there was clearly information out there in the meteorological community that was coming. So there still seems to be a disconnect. I often see in the media at times that tornado came without warning is the headline. Well, actually, there were probably several hours to perhaps days of watcher warning or outlooks from the Storm Prediction Center on those storms. So there's a disconnect, even not amongst ourselves, but even in terms of communicating more broadly through the media and the decision makers in our society.
Marshall, thanks a lot for talking today.
Thank you so much.
Marshall Shepard is host of the Weather Geeks on the Weather Channel and director of the University of Georgia's Atmospheric Sciences Program, also a former NASA scientist. He'll be speaking at 7 o'clock tonight in Madison at the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery.
Coming up after the news, as some people, including mental health professionals, speculate about the president's mental health, our guest psychiatrist says President Trump isn't crazy, but our society is. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
To Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a new study shows that by 2050, the percentage of solar energy worldwide will be 3 times higher than originally projected. We'll talk to a UW professor about why previous projections were so far off.
First, an online petition put out earlier this year called for mental health professionals to demand President Trump's removal from office due to mental illness. That's one example of speculation about the president's mental health.
However, our guest psychiatrist wrote a letter to the New York Times saying that while he thinks the president is, quote, badly behaved, he isn't mentally ill. Rather, he says the real question to face is this: what does the election of Trump as the country's leader say about the American people?
Dr. Alan Francis joins us now. He's professor emeritus and former chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at the Duke University School of Medicine. He's the author of the new book, Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump. Dr. Francis, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure.
Well, you write that you had actually started this book before Donald Trump was a candidate for president. You saw something in the American psyche that had you worried. What was that?
We're not worried about our kids. We're not worried about our grandkids. We're doing things to our world that will bequeath to them something much worse than we inherited. So that I was very worried about the disastrous denial of global warming. Overpopulation, every trouble spot in the world is a trouble spot because of excessive population. The world population has tripled in my lifetime. resources are disappearing. So many, many problems that our society is delusionally denying, not facing. And then Trump came on the scene, and he put our denial on speed so that all the worst possible policies that we could imagine, he's now instituted. And so I think it's a wake-up call. Either we're going to go down the tubes with Trump, or he's going to give us a kind of shock treatment to get us back to sanity.
And you see kind of one common theme here with those problems you mentioned. They're long-term, serious, complex problems. And you say there's a part of our minds, not just as Americans, as humans, that wants an attractive short-term solution or maybe complete denial of the problem. Is that the core tension here?
Yeah, I guess you have to realize that our brains were wired for the situations our ancestors faced 50,000 years ago. They didn't know whether they'd be alive tomorrow, that they might not find lunch or there might be lunch for a predator. And our brains are wired to make quick emotional decisions. That parts of our brains that are rational have very little control over the parts that are irrational, and they take a lot more time and a lot more effort to work. So Donald Trump represents all that's most primitive in our thinking, most irrational, and he's the accentuation of what was previously going on in America. I think we have to start getting together as a people, recognizing that we have problems, the world has problems, and we have to find solutions that we can agree on. And when you poll the American public, it's a lot less polarized than the politicians. A lot of money has gone into the political process in tearing us apart for the special interests of the very rich and the greedy corporations. I think that the American public's a lot smarter than you'd think when you listen to our president or to the people in Congress. And the tenor of the book is a kind of hopelessness about where things are now, but a hopefulness that we can take this dark age of Trump and turn it back into an enlightenment period.
Now, keying in on President Trump in particular, you're no fan of the president. You make no secret of that. But you say to your colleagues in the mental health profession, don't diagnose him from a distance, and from all signs, we shouldn't be talking about him as someone with a mental illness. Talk about that.
That's a real distraction. I think that the guy is obviously unfit to be president. He's been exactly like this his whole life. He's a big baby, a spoiled brat grown up. He cares only about Trump. He's a con man. He's a liar. We made a bad mistake. But we're not going to correct it with psychological name-calling. Trump is a political problem that we have to face and solve with political tools. Congress has to step in, this new session. They have to step in and start taming him. I am terrified of the thought that he could wake up in the middle of the night and instead of shooting out a nasty tweet, start a war with North Korea. It should be clear to the president that Congress declares war, not Donald Trump. He shouldn't be alone there in the nuclear button. There should be a committee structure, a protocol for making life and death decisions for the whole world. These decisions can't be left on the finger of someone as immature on the nuclear button as he would likely be. So I think that the mental health professionals who would like to declare him mentally unfit to serve as president, they're right about his being unfit. They're wrong about the diagnosis, and they're naive about the possibility of Pence and the majority of the cabinet ever removing Trump from office based on psychiatric grounds. That just will never happen. It's a distraction to be worrying about the Trump reality show and his psychological motivations every day. We need to tame his policies and not let them sneak things through, like a tax cut that would be a wonderful bonanza for the very rich and really terrible for the rest of us.
Talking to Dr. Alan Francis, author of the new book, Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump. Now, Dr. Francis, you're talking to a state where more people voted for Donald Trump than his main opponent or any of his opponents. There are people out there listening thinking, what the heck are you talking about? Are you saying we're crazy for voting for President Trump? What would you say to them?
I think there's buyer's remorse amongst a lot of people, and his approval ratings have gone down significantly and will go down further. I think the message that was sent to the country by Donald Trump's election was a very powerful and appropriate message. Many people are suffering. This used to be a worker's paradise. It's now a worker's hell. The rural towns are being completely deserted. The young people are leaving for the cities or for the army. The stores are boarded up. I understand the pain in the country. The message is valid, and we shouldn't discredit the people who are sending it. But Trump is the worst possible messenger. He's a false prophet. He's a fake, a phony, a con man. He's not doing things for the common man. The people he's appointed to the cabinet are billionaires. The tax cut he's proposing is for billionaires. He's made it much harder for workers to get a fair deal. I think if a person in Wisconsin is a patriot and loves America, will they want someone like Donald Trump, who seems to prefer Putin and to believe him more than our own security agencies? I think that for religious people, Donald Trump is not a Christian. He's the exact opposite of Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ never once spoke about abortion or about birth control or about gay marriage. Even though all of these were going on in the Roman Empire, he did revile religious hypocrites. I think that the evangelical leaders have been religious hypocrites, selling their souls to get Trump elected. So I think that gradually let's answer a minute. How many people want to be associated with Nazis, Aryans, and Ku Klux Klan racists and anti-Semites? So I think that people who voted for Trump, I don't expect to change their minds in 10 minutes, but I would hope to open their minds to the fact that he was a clever con man, a reality TV host who was able to fool a large percentage of the people enough to get elected. But as Abraham Lincoln said, you can fool all the people some of the time, you can fool some of the people all the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. And I think a lot of people who voted for Trump must be experiencing buyer's remorse. I hope they are.
You also write that the success of Donald Trump is also in part a failure of Democrats to recognize the pain in many communities out there and to speak to that pain.
Oh, yeah. The Democrats have been weak in victory and pathetic in defeat. I think that if you look at the voting records and the legislative achievements over the last 60 years, the common man has been much better served by the Democratic Party. But the Democratic Party has not been skillful in providing a message that would resonate with the people who they were serving. So they've been an ivory tower intellectual kind of world that didn't recognize that people were suffering, that they needed both the bills and the message. And my hope is that this will be a wake-up call. The American people can't depend on the radical right, which has now taken over the Republican Party. They can't depend on the Democratic Party, which has been weak and which is now gerrymandered into a position of tremendous disadvantage throughout the country. I think the American people have to start saying, we need to take our country back, not with the fake astroturf populism of the Tea Party, but with a real, what's decent about America? How do we really make it? We can't make America great again unless we make it good again.
We're talking to Dr. Alan Francis, author of the new book, Twilight of American Sanity. A psychiatrist analyzes the age of Trump, but what he sees the rise of Trump revealing about the national psyche of the United States.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the election of President Trump, what that says about our country? And what do you think about the state of the national psyche? What do you think are the biggest challenges we face in our deeply polarized nation? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're continuing our conversation about the election of President Trump and what that says about the nation's mental outlook. Dr. Alan Francis is with us. He's the author of Twilight of American Sanity, a psychiatrist analyzes the age of Trump.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. In a time of deep political polarization, what do you think politicians need to do to move the country past the lines we've drawn? What steps do you think we'd need to heal? And what is the right way for a politician to reach out to communities that are feeling economic, cultural, social distress? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Mike is with us in Wausau. Mike, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
Just a couple quick comments. Just one thing I thought about the election was that when I spoke with people on the right, it wasn't as much about how they thought that Trump was going to make things better, but it was just how evil Hillary was, and that's all they could talk about was Hillary. And the other thing is, it seems like with the bubble that we live in today, we don't hear the same message. I mean, the right seems to think things are going rosy, and until we all hear the same message, it's really going to be hard to change.
Mike, thanks for the call. Let's tackle that second point first. We're all living, in some ways, in our own media reality, Dr. Francis. How do we get past that?
Well, it's a great comments. I think that there's been a 40-year concerted, expensive, and very successful propaganda campaign that split our country apart. And talk radio is the clearest manifestation, and websites that express the views of the radical right, Fox News. I think that Hillary Clinton would have been an average president. It's a little bit and weirdly ironic that Donald Trump is calling anyone else a crook, and the news, the truth other people are expressing is all fake, and the snake oil that he puts out is all true. But a substantial part of the population bought it. 46% on election day, about 35% now. Donald Trump has said that he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and his voters would still vote for him. I think that's not completely true, but it's true enough. And I blame this a lot on the fact that although the information available to us now, at just the click of an internet button, is so amazingly rich. There's never been a time when people had more information available to them. At the same time, our judgment and our wisdom is sorely lacking. And it's partly because all of us are in these little bubbles, and we have to find the common ground. We will not survive as a civilization if we allow the kind of global warming and the hurricanes that are falling from it that are supposed to be once every 500 years, now happening every 2 weeks. We will not be able to survive this future unless we can come to common sense decisions and policies and plans. And it's a ridiculous thing that Donald Trump has destroyed the Environmental Protection Agency in just a few months. He's appointed energy company lackeys to the most powerful cabinet positions. He's deregulated the energy industry. And the prayers and thoughts that go from the hypocritical leaders to the people of Texas are really very small consolation compared to what we should be doing after these major storms, and that is thinking about how are we going to stop these from happening on such a regular basis in the future. How do we control global warming? I think if people think about the issues in a common sense way rather than from an ideological perspective spouting what they've read in the latest internet thing from Breitbart and what they've heard from Fox News, I think an open-minded view of where we have to go in the future, there'd be a lot less polarization. I think the American people are a lot sounder in their judgments than the polls of the political parties.
Mike, thanks for the call. Go next to Peter in Friendship. Peter, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Okay.
Yep, go for it.
Yeah, I have a question for you. The thing is, all politicians lie, no matter if they're Democratic or Republican or whatever, just to get into the power that they persuade they think they need to be in. But the question I have is, where do you get your information as that Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders would have been a better candidate as a president than Donald Trump when Hillary Clinton was caught in lies? In the same line as Obama when he lied.
Peter, thanks for the call. So Hillary Clinton, any politician has been caught out in lies, sometimes big ones. Is Donald Trump really that much different than what we've seen from other politicians?
Yeah, Donald Trump is a world-class liar without parallel in American political history. He lies many times every day. He flip-flops back on his lies without ever admitting that he had a different lie the day before. It's a false equivalence. There are evils, greater evils and lesser evils. It's a false equivalence to think that Hillary Clinton lied and that her lies somehow equal, the occasional lies, equal Trump's day in and day out lies. Trump is the biggest threat to American democracy since the Civil War. The two biggest protections we have against dictatorship are free press and free courts. And Donald Trump's been attacking both of those. And the assumption that Donald Trump is telling the truth and that the entire media is lying, you have to be pretty gullible to believe that. And what I would suggest is get out from the bubble, stop watching Fox News so much, get into the what they now seem as the evil mainstream press, and read a number of different places. Check yourself the facts of what Trump says. See how he flip-flops. And I don't think you'll see he's an equivalent liar. He is the world-class liar in American political history.
Thanks for the call. Is it overstating things, Dr. Francis? I mean, Donald Trump has attacked the press and the courts rhetorically. I mean, a dictator is going to take actual action to shut down a newspaper or throw out a judge they don't like.
Well, he was trying to change the libel laws in ways that would have enforced self-censorship. The great thing about Donald Trump is his utter incompetence and his self-absorption. So he is so bad at what he does that I'm much less afraid of his becoming a dictator now than I was 6 months ago. And in fact, the thing that the value he brings to the political discussion now is we can begin to see all the weaknesses in our system that he's been trying to exploit, and we need to strengthen them.
Talking to Dr. Alan Francis, his new book is Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump. Back to our callers now with Bob on the line in Reidsville. Bob, hi.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking the call. I have a concern, and I see hatred in the man. He hated Barack Obama well before Barack Obama was elected president and denied his citizenship. He has done unbelievable kinds of things to, and I understand Barack Obama got even with him at one point at a press dinner. Okay, I understand that. But the other hatred I see is the hatred of Mexicans. And it's like he absolutely, I mean, to the point that we talked Ford Motor Company out of building a plant to make their Focus model in Mexico. They're going to make it and build it in China now and make a couple hundred dollars more per car.
Bob, we're a little low on time. Dr. Francis, do you see that hate from the president, and do you see it as reflecting something in the rest of us in American culture?
Well, at the very beginning of Donald Trump's career, he was in a lawsuit with the Justice Department because his apartment buildings would not rent or sell to blacks. And he has a long history of being a bigot. But I think a lot of the racism he's recently made so public is more opportunistic. That this was a way he was able to win the presidency, a way he was able to solidify the ugliest portion of his bloc. And I think Donald Trump, the two things to understand about Donald Trump are, think about a spoiled four-year-old brat and think about a reality TV show host. That he will do anything for ratings, he'll do anything to keep his base together, and he'll pander if it requires pandering. So I don't think in his heart of hearts he cares that much whether we accept migrants or don't accept migrants. He only cares about Donald Trump. And he will espouse the worst possible policies if it will further his own self-interest.
Dr. Francis, as we wrap up, let's set President Trump aside for a moment. What is your prescription for the American people? In a difficult time, there have been a lot of difficult times that we've gotten through before. What do you hope to see from everyday American people?
Well, this month is tax courts reform month in Washington. People should be demonstrating against big giveaways to the rich and to the corporations. The 20 richest people in America today now have more wealth than the poorest half of the population. They don't need a tax break. Donald Trump doesn't need a tax break. We should have been much more active in protecting Obamacare. There were far too few demonstrations. The public needs to demonstrate their displeasure with this takeover of radical right-wing policies. But I think the main thing is looking forward to 2018. There's a big disadvantage in the way the country has been gerrymandered, but it's not insurmountable. And I think we have to take our country back from Donald Trump.
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Francis, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Dr. Alan Francis. He's a professor emeritus and former chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at Duke University's School of Medicine. He's the author of the book we've been talking about, Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump. We've got a link to an article that he wrote over at the Central Time Facebook page. You can check it out and share your thoughts while you're there. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Coming up at 7 o'clock tonight, you can join us for CBC Radio's As It Happens. We'll hear news and interviews from around the world on As It Happens. And then at 8 o'clock, it's Q from the CBC with an interview with comedian Lewis Black, known for smart, angry rants, especially on the topic of American politics. But these days, it seems that everyone's joking about that particular topic that's a problem for Lewis. We'll find out why. That's coming up at 8 o'clock on the CBC's Q.
In the meantime, news is coming up. Stick around for more here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.
One of the most distinctive words in the Wisconsin lexicon is bubbler, as in a drinking fountain.
You can be pretty sure that anyone who calls a fountain a bubbler is from Wisconsin, right? But where did the word come from?
We thought we had the answer with a Wisconsin calendar that said the bubbler was invented by the Kohler Company on this day in 1888, but hold on there.
In looking for more background, it looks like the bubbler origin story might be more controversial, even an urban legend. A few years back, the head of the Sheboygan County Historical Society wrote about the origins of the bubbler.
She writes that there's no record of a bubbler patent by anyone in Wisconsin at that time, and that the Kohler Company didn't start making bubblers until around 1900, and they didn't start making the piece that makes the water bubble out of that apparatus for another 25 years or so.
So we'll try to get to the bottom of the true story at some point here in Central Time, maybe see if the person who wrote that piece can join us. But, you know, I came here from Michigan about halfway through my life. Gradually, I picked up bubbler. Do you say it?
I do say bubbler, but then my grandparents were from Milwaukee, and it's something that stayed with me. I still say bubbler, and it shocked me at first that other people don't call it that.
I was visiting someone in San Francisco, and I was at a theater, and I asked the staff where the bubbler was. And then I realized I really am from Wisconsin now as they stared at me.
What really gave it away was when you asked for cheese curds.
Then yeah, I had a brandy old-fashioned. Yeah, it just went south from there. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.